"Shouldn't bloody ought to do that, Fraser," the man on the chair-arm said, unfolding his legs and standing. Oliphant noted a certain calculation evident in his tone, like the swarthy man he was newly and nattily kitted out, all in Oxford Street's latest, his coat of engine-cut gabardine dyed a blue that verged on lavender. Oliphant saw that his lapel, like that of his companion, was decorated with a gleaming cloisonnier badge in the shape of the Union Jack.
"Bloody Mr. Tate,"
Fraser said, a schoolmaster about to deliver a tongue-lashing or worse.
"Fair warning, Fraser," the swarthy man said, his dark eyes protruding. "We're about parliamentary business."
The little brown terrier shivered in his arms.
"Are you, then?" Oliphant inquired mildly. "And what business has Parliament in a rat pit?" "Might ask the same of you, eh?"
the taller man said insolently, then coughed. Fraser glared at him.
"Fraser," Oliphant said, "are these gentlemen the confidential agents you mentioned in regard to Dr. Mallory?"
"Tate and Velasco," Fraser said grimly.
"Mr. Tate," Oliphant said, stepping forward. "A pleasure, sir. I am Lawrence Oliphant, journalist."
Tate blinked, confused by Oliphant's cordiality. Fraser, rather reluctantly taking Oliphant's cue, released Velasco's arm.
"Mr. Velasco," Oliphant smiled.
Velasco's face clouded with suspicion.
"Journalist? What sort of journalist?"
he demanded, glancing from Oliphant to Fraser and back.
"Travel pieces, primarily," Oliphant said, "though I'm currently engaged, with Mr. Fraser's able help, in compiling a popular history of the Great Stink."
Tate peered narrowly at Oliphant.
"Mallory," you said. "What about him?"
"I interviewed Dr. Mallory prior to his departure for China. His experiences during the Stink were most remarkable, and highly illustrative of the perils that might befall anyone during such a chaotic period."
"Befall anyone?" Velasco challenged.
"Rubbish. Mallory's trouble was Savantry trouble, and your Mr. Fraser knows it well enough."
"Yes, yes, quite," Oliphant agreed,
"and that is why I am delighted to have encountered you gentlemen tonight."
Velasco and Tate glanced uncertainly at one another.
"You are?"
Tate ventured.
"Utterly. You see, Dr. Mallory explained to me the unfortunate contretemps with his rival and fellow savant, Peter Falk. It seems, you see, that even in the most rarefied circles, during a period of such unprecedented stress—"
"You not see Peter Bloody Falk moving in your rarefied bloody circles now," Velasco interjected, "not for all his gentry posing."
He paused for effect.
"He was discovered in bed with a girl not 12 years old."
"No,"
Oliphant feigned shock.
"Falk! But surely—"
"He was," Tate affirmed, "in Brighton, and those as found him beat the bugger silly and flung him stark naked into the street."
"But it wasn't us that did it," Velasco stated flatly, "and you'll not prove it was."
"There's a new trend of thought about," Tate said, thrusting his shallow chest forward so as to better display his Union Jack insignia, the gin-reddened tip of his button nose glinting wetly. "Such as doesn't tolerate decadence," giving equal stress to the word's three syllables, "be it in the savantry, or however high at all. Hidden wickedness ran rife under Byron, all manner of it, and well you know it, Fraser."
Fraser's eyes widened at this effrontery, as Tate turned in his excitement to Oliphant.
"That stink was Ned Ludd's work, mister, and there's your history of it."
"Sabotage on a titanic scale,"
Velasco pronounced darkly, as if quoting from a speech,
"abetted by conspirators in the highest ranks of society. But there are true patriots among us, sir, patriots at work to root that evil out."
The terrier growled in Velasco's arms, and Fraser looked on the verge of throttling man and dog alike.
"We're parliamentary investigators," Tate said, "about a member's business, and I'm sure you'd not care to detain us."
Oliphant put his hand upon Fraser's sleeve. With a smirk of triumph, Velasco soothed his little dog and sauntered to the stairs. Tate followed. From overhead came the mad yapping of dogs and the hoarse cries of sportsmen.
"They're working for Egremont," Oliphant said.
Fraser's face twisted with disgust. Disgust and something akin to amazement.
"There seems nothing more to be done here, Fraser. I take it you arranged for a cab?"
Mr. Mori Arinori, Oliphant's favourite among his young Japanese pupils, took a fierce delight in all things British.
Oliphant, who customarily breakfasted lightly, if at all, would sometimes subject himself to massive English breakfasts to please Morrie, who on this particular occasion wore the burliest of golfing tweeds and a scarf in the tartan of the Royal Hibernian Order of Steam Engineers. There was a certain enjoyably melancholy sense of paradox, Oliphant mused, in watching Morrie spread a slice of toast with marmalade, while he himself indulged a nostalgia for his own days in Japan, where he had served as first secretary under Rutherford Alcock. His stay in Edo had nurtured in him a passionate regard for the muted tones and subtle textures of a world of ritual and shadow. He longed now for the rattle of rain blown against oiled paper, for flowering weeds anod down tiny alleys, the glow of rush lamps, for scents and darknesses, the shadows of the low city.
"Oliphant-san, a toast is very good, is most excellent. You are sad, Oliphant-san?"
"No, Mr. Morrie,
not at all."
He helped himself to bacon, though he wasn't hungry in the least. He put aside a sudden intrusive memory of the morning's hideous bath, the black, clinging rubber.
"I was recalling Edo. That city possessed great charm for me."
Morrie chewed bread and marmalade, regarding Oliphant steadily with his bright, dark eyes, then dabbed expertly at his lips with a linen napkin.
"Charm, your word for the old ways. The old ways hinder my nation. Only this week have I posted to Satsuma an argument against the wearing of swords."
The bright eyes darted for a fractional moment toward the crooked fingers of Oliphant's left hand, as if stung by the pressure of Morrie's awareness, the scar beneath Oliphant's cuff began a slow ache.
"But, Mr. Morrie,"
Oliphant said, setting his silver fork aside to abandon the unwanted bacon,
"the sword, in your country, is in many respects the focal symbol of the feudal ethic and the sentiments attaching to it, an object of reverence second only to one's own lord."
Morrie smiled, pleased.
"Odious custom of a rude and savage age. This is good to be rid of, Oliphant-san. This is a modern day."
This latter a favourite and frequent expression. Oliphant returned the smile. Morrie combined boldness and compassion with a certain problematical brashness that Oliphant found most appealing. More than once, to Bly's dismay, Morrie had paid some cockney cabman full fare plus tip and then invited the fellow into Oliphant's kitchen for a meal.
"But you must learn to proceed apace, Mr. Morrie. While you yourself may regard the wearing of swords as a primitive custom, to openly oppose this minor matter might well provoke resistance to other, more important reforms, the deeper changes you wish to implement in your society."
Morrie nodded gravely.
"Your policy, no doubt, has merit, Oriphant-san. Far better, for example, if all Japanese were taught English. Our meagre tongue is of no use in the great world beyond our islands. Soon power of steam and the engine must pervade our land. English language, following such, must suppress any use of Japanese. Our intelligent race, eager in pursuit of knowledge, cannot depend on weak and uncertain medium of communication. We must grasp principal truths from precious treasury of Western science."
Oliphant tilted his head to one side, considering Morrie carefully.
"Mr. Morrie," he said, "pardon me if I misunderstand you, but am I correct in assuming that you are proposing nothing less than the deliberate abolition of the Japanese language?"
"This is modern day, Oliphant-san, modern day. All reasons support our tongue's disuse."
Oliphant smiled.
"We must arrange to discuss this at length, Mr. Morrie, but now I must ask if you are engaged this evening. I propose an entertainment."
"By all means, Oriphant-san. English social festivities are ever gratifying,"
Morrie beamed.
"We shall go then to Whitechapel, to the Garrick Theatre, for what I understand is a most unusual pantomime."
According to the spottily stippled programme, the clown was known as Jackdaw Jaculation, though this was perhaps the least peculiar aspect of that evening's performance by the Manhattan Women's Red Pantomime Troupe of Mazulam the Night Owl. Other characters included Freedom Bureau Bill, a black boy, Levy Stickmall, a merchant, offering 2 cigars for 5 cents, a Yankee peddler, a lady shoplifter, a roast turkey, and the eponymous Mazulam. All of the players, to judge by the programme, were female, though in several cases this would otherwise have been quite impossible to determine. The clown, ornate with frills in elaborately spangled satin, boasted an egg-bald, shaven pate, and the sinister white face of the Pierrot, touched with colour only in the outlined lips. The performance had been preceded by a brief ranting address from one Helen America, her heaving, apparently unconstrained bosom through layers of diaphanous scarves serving to hold the attention of the predominantly masculine audience. Her speech had consisted of slogans Oliphant found rather more cryptic than rousing. What exactly did it mean, for instance, when she declared that we have nothing to wear but our chains? Consulting the programme, he was informed that Helen America was in fact the authoress of Mazulem the Night Owl, as well as Harlequin Panataha and Genii of the Algonquins. Musical accompaniment was provided by a moon-faced organist, her eyes, it seemed to Oliphant, glinting either with lunacy or laudanum. The pantomime had opened in what Oliphant supposed was meant to be taken as a hotel dining room, with the peripatetic roast turkey, apparently played by a dwarf, attacking the diners with a carving knife. Oliphant had very quickly lost track of the narrative, if indeed there were one, which he doubted. Scenes were punctuated repeatedly by characters firing stuffed bricks at one another's heads. There was kinotropic accompaniment, of a sort, though it consisted of crudely polemical cartoons that seemed to bear little relationship to the action. Oliphant stole a glance at Maury, who sat beside him, his treasured topper upright on his lap, his face expressionless. The audience was howlingly rowdy, though less in response to the substance of the pantomime, whatever that might be, than to the whirling, curiously formless dances of the communard women, their bare shins and ankles plainly visible beneath the ragged hems of their flowing garments. Oliphant's back began to ache. The choreography accelerated into a sort of balletic assault, the air thick with brickbats, until, quite abruptly, Mazulem the Night Owl was ended. The crowd hooted, applauded, jeered. Oliphant noted a hulking, gaunt-jawed man with a stout rattan over his shoulder, lounging beside the entrance to the pit. The fellow was watching the crowd through narrowed eyes. "Come, then, Mr. Maury. I sense a journalistic opportunity." Maury stood, hat and evening cane in hand. He followed Oliphant toward the pit. "Lawrence Oliphant, journalist," he presented his card to the hulking man. "If you be so kind, you might convey this to Miss America with my request for an interview." The man took the card, glanced at it, and let it fall to the floor. Oliphant saw the knobby fist tighten around the rattan. Maury emitted a brief hiss as if of steam. Oliphant turned. Maury, his top hat jammed firmly forward on his head, had assumed the pose of the samurai warrior, the handle of his evening cane grasped in both his hands. Immaculate linen and gold links glinted at his supple wrists. The untidily coiffed, extravagantly hennaed head of Helen America appeared. Her eyes were ringed with kohl. Maury held his pose. "Miss Helen America?" Oliphant produced a second card. "Allow me to introduce myself. I am Lawrence Oliphant, journalist." Helen America performed a rapid manipulation before the stony face of her compatriot, as though she were conjuring something from the air. The man lowered his length of rattan, still glowering fiercely at Maury. The stick, Oliphant saw, was obviously weighted. "Cecil's a deaf-mute," she said, pronouncing the name with a case-hardened American E. "I'm very sorry. I offered my card." "He can't read. You say you're a newspaper man?" "An occasional journalist. And you, Miss America, are an authoress of the first water. Allow me to introduce my good friend, Mr. Maury Arinori, an envoy of the Mikado of Japan." With a deadly glance at Cecil, Maury reversed his cane with admirable grace, removed his hat, and bowed in the European fashion. Helen America, wide-eyed, regarded him as one might a trained dog. She wore a neatly mended military cloak, threadbare, but apparently clean, in the shade of grey the Confederates called butternut, though the original regimental buttons had been replaced with plain round horn. "I haven't ever seen a Chinaman dress like that," she said. "Mr. Maury is Japanese, and you're a newspaper man." "After a fashion, yes." Helen America smiled, revealing a gold tooth. "And did you enjoy our show?" "It was extraordinary, quite extraordinary." Her smile widened. "Then come to Manhattan, mister, for the people risen have the old Olympic east of Broadway over Houston Street.
we're best appreciated in our own venue." Thin bands of silver pierced her ears amid a tangled cloud of hennaed curls.
"It would be my great pleasure, as it would be my pleasure to conduct an interview with the authoress of
"I didn't write that," she said. "Fox did."
"Pardon me?"
"George Washington Lafayette Fox, the Marxian Grimaldi, the Tumler of socialist pantomime. It was the troops' decision to put that I wrote it, though I continue to argue against it."
"But your prefatory message?"
"Now, I did write that, sir, and I'm proud of it. But poor Fox."
"I hadn't heard,"
Oliphant submitted, somewhat baffled. "It was the terrible pressure of toil," she said. "The great Fox, who'd single-handedly elevated socialist pantomime to its present level of revolutionary importance, was sweated mad by one-night stands, sir, driven to sheer exhaustion at having to contrive sharper tricks and quicker transformations. He slid into dementia then, his grimaces hideous to behold."
She had assumed her stage delivery. Now she lapsed back into a more confidential tone.
"He lapsed into the crudest indecency, mister. So we kept his dresser in a monkey suit to run out and belabor him if he got too obscene."
"I'm very sorry."
"Manhattan's no place for the mad, sir, sad to say. He's in the asylum in Somerville, Massachusetts, and if you'd care to publish that, be my guest."
Oliphant found that he was staring at her, entirely at a loss for words. Moriarty Nori had retired somewhat and seemed to be watching the crowd as it made its way out of the garrick. The deaf-mute Cecil had vanished, taking with him his shot-loaded length of rattan.
"I could eat a horse," Helen America said cheerfully. "Allow me, please, to provide you with a meal. Where do you wish to dine?"
"There's a place around the corner." As she stepped from the topmost of the steps that ascended the pit, Oliphant saw that she wore a pair of the rubber boots Americans called Chickamaugas, great, clumsy things of military origin. With Maury at his side, he followed her out of the garrick. She had not waited for him to offer his arm. She led them down the street, and, as she had said, around a corner. Gaslight flared before a clacking kino sign that checkered from Moses and Sons Auto Café into Clean Modern Rapid, and back again. Helen America glanced back with an encouraging smile, her Calipigian hips swaying beneath the Confederate cloak and the tattered muslin of her remarkable stage garment. The Auto Café was crowded and noisy, packed with Whitechapel locals. Its iron-mullioned windows were opaque with steam. Oliphant had seen nothing like it before. Helen America demonstrated how business was conducted here, taking up a rectangular gutta-percha tray from a stack of the things and pushing it along a ledge of shining zinc. Above the ledge were several dozen miniature windows, trimmed with brass. Oliphant and Maury followed her example. Behind each window, a different dish was displayed. Oliphant, noting the coin slots, fumbled for his change purse. Helen America chose a slice of shepherd's pie, a helping of toad-in-the-hole, and fried chips, Oliphant providing the requisite coinage. An additional tuppence produced a copious quantity of very dubious-looking brown gravy from a spigot. Maury chose a baked potato, a particular favourite of his, but declined the gravy spigot. Oliphant, disoriented by the oddness of the place, opted for a pint of machine-made ale from another spigot.
"Clystra's liable to kill me for this,"
Helen America remarked, as they arranged their trays on a ridiculously small cast-iron table. The table, like the four chairs around it, was bolted into the concrete floor.
"Doesn't hold with us talking to gentlemen of the press."
She shrugged beneath her butternut cloak. She smiled happily and began to sort a small pile of cheap tinware, giving Maury a knife and dinner fork.
"Have you been to a town called Brighton, mister?"
"Yes, actually, I have.
What kind of place is that?"
Maury was examining, with keen interest, the rectangular dish of coarse grey cardboard beneath his potato.
"It's very pleasant," Oliphant said. "Very picturesque. The Hydropathic Pavilion is quite famous."
"Is it in England?" Helen America asked, around a mouthful of toad in the hole.
"It is, yes. Lot of working folks?"
"Perhaps not, in the sense I take you to mean, though the various facilities and attractions employ a great many people."
"Haven't seen a real factory crowd since we got here. Well, let's eat."
And with that, Helen America bent to the task. Dinner conversation, Oliphant gathered, was not highly valued in Red Manhattan. She left the cardboard dishes utterly devoid of scraps or crumbs, contriving to sop up the last dross of gravy with a chip she had carefully retained for this purpose. Oliphant took out his notebook. Opening it, he removed a plain white card stippled with Florence Bartlett's Bow Street portrait.
Are you familiar at all with Flora Barnett, the American actress, Miss America? She's enormously popular in Manhattan, or so I was recently told.
Oliphant displayed the card.
She's no actress, mister, nor an American either. She's a Southron, if you can even call her that. Next thing to a damn Frenchie. The people risen don't need her kind. Hell, we've already hung our share of 'em. Her kind?
Helen America met his gaze with a defiant stare.
In a pig's eye, you're a journalist. I'm sorry, if sorry like the rest of 'em. You give just about that much of a damn. Miss America, please, I wish only to—
Thanks for the feed, mister, but you can't pump me, understand? And that brontosaur, that's got no damn business over here in the first place. You got no right to it, and one day it'll sit in the Manhattan Metropolitan, for it belongs to the people risen. And what makes you Limers think you can come digging up the people's natural treasures?
And in through the door, as if on cue, marched the very formidable clown of the Manhattan Women's Red Pantomime Troupe, her bald pate hugely bonneted in polka-dot gingham, and her Chickamauga boots even larger than Helen America's.
"Coming right this minute, Comrade Clystra,"
Helen America said.
The clown fixed Oliphant with a murderous glare, and then the two were gone.
Oliphant looked at Maury.
"A peculiar evening, Mr. Maury."
Maury, apparently lost in contemplation of the auto-café's clatter and bustle, took a moment to respond.
"We will have places such as this in my country, Oriphant-san. Clean, modern, rapid."